The following is paid for by the Coalition for a Better Hollywood. For decades, Big Movie has had Hollywood studios in their back pocket. They spend millions to get you to spend billions on movies that are nothing more than sequels, reboots, remakes, reimaginings, Oscar cliche and January releases. Big movie lobbyists have all but ensured original film ideas are ignored, forgotten, or maybe not even real. Are they feature films? Are they quality flicks? Are they real motion pictures? Your soon-to-be, if not already favorite movie podcast stands with the little movies. Help put an end to Big Movie's cinematic censorship and listen to the pop-up film cast every Tuesday wherever honest hard-working podcasts can be found. We are the Pop-Up Film Cast, a proud member of the Podfix Network, and we support this message.
You know, I was trying to think of the best way to open the show up today, and I thought we would throw our thoughts out about which of our three cats would make the best cat bus.
Okay.
I think Elfie would easily be the roomiest.
She's the most spacious, for sure.
Absolutely. If you want to travel, not the fastest.
But George would be the fastest, but he would crash the bus.
Right.
He's like, who's the Simpsons bus driver?
Oh, he's like Otto.
He's high.
Yeah.
He had some catnip, so he's
not
just
very
kinda
bright. He's kind of all over the place. Elfie's slow, but yes, very comfortable.
Really, you don't want a cat for a bus. They're not reliant for time.
Well, that brings us to Django. I think Django would be the most steady, level-headed cat bus in our household.
Django's more of a limousine.
He's
a tuxedo cat.
Yeah, he's one of those party buses that, chauffeurs you around, you're having a good time, and he's just all business. He's there to get you there.
That's right. There's only champagne, no cheap beer in
That's
the back
right.
of his
yeah,
bus.
Yeah, no frat boys and weird roofie shenanigans going on back there. This is all about hot traveling in style.
That's right.
That's Django. That's our tuxedo cat bus.
I'll take a ride on.
I would too.
Tuxedo cat bus.
If Django said, "I'm going to take you to work today, hop in," I would be like, "No problem." If George says that, I'll wait for the next bus.
I'll go with just because I want to see.
I don't know.
I don't think we're going to work, but we're going to end up somewhere.
You're going to end up somewhere, and the ride's going to be crazy.
That's right. Under a bridge, or who knows where.
Who knows? Anyway.
Cat bus.
Cat bus. Hello and welcome to The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. I am Phil Rude, the dad.
I'm Austin Rude, the son. Every week we watch a movie and then we talk about it right in front of this very mic.
And right in front of your father. I'm not one of these negligent parents who lets their child roam through the forest. I keep my kid here in front of the microphone like a good dad.
I'm chained to my dad 24/7.
I've got one of those backpack leashes on that.
That's right.
People put on their toddlers at Disney World.
When I go to work, it's inside a hamster ball.
Safety first. How you doing, Oz?
I'm good.
Good.
Yeah.
All right.
Well kept.
Yeah.
Yeah. Groomed.
Groomed and put together well.
That's right.
You had a fresh haircut. Got your styling mustache.
That's right.
You're stepping out. It's good times.
That's it. Right. I don't know what to say about this week.
What have you been up? Nothing? You haven't been up to anything?
Not really. I'd say Superstore. That's something.
Yeah? Tell me about Superstore.
Well, it's weird. I'm on their sixth season, which is also their last season. And I started watching it when it was airing, but because of COVID and also because one of the lead stars, left the show, but then the show was canceled because of COVID, so they kind of just brought her back for the ending anyway. It was this weird thing.
It was America Ferrera, right?
Yeah. She wanted to leave, and they were going to keep the show going.
Yeah.
But then there were complications, so they were like, we'll just end it on a high note with everyone.
Huh.
And then...
Interesting.
So yeah, it took a while. It's all out now. I just have to watch it. So cool. I've been making my way through the season.
Making your way through...
It's very weird.
Through the Superstore, through Cloud Nine.
Yeah, my main complaint is that they tried to do the realism of... We're going to include masks and social commentary right. on COVID, but we're also going to be a show and show their faces. So they're going to be holding their masks in 99% of the scenes and not following guidelines.
Yeah.
But also we're going to act like they're following guidelines. It's just weird and uncomfortable. And I feel like they should have just kept it out of the show if you want to keep it light.
I think a lot of shows that have continued to... film during this past year. I haven't seen very many of them, but that's a common complaint I've heard from a lot of them is like, they want to address it. They want to include it, but sometimes people are wearing masks. Sometimes they aren't. It just sort of like depends on the scene.
There's Shameless that I like, where they're doing,
I can't believe that show is still on.
I know it's ending soon, but it's on its last legs. But they put their actors in a bubble, and then they, like, went through and they were like, your character is going to wear realistic masks. Yours is going to sew their own masks. Yours is going to have it under the nose. Yours won't wear them at all. Yours will throw a fight. Based on, like, what the character would actually do.
Interesting.
Which is, I think, a nice way to do realism.
Sure, that's bringing it into the story. But then when you have,
It informs the character, then. It becomes a thing.
You have something like Superstore, where it's like, yeah, working in a department store, you would be required to wear a mask. Yeah. And then they just don't wear them in half the scenes. It's weird.
It's like, oh, we're in the break room. We have it in our hands.
Yeah, which, as someone who delivers to stores, I can tell
people
you...
People do that.
That is kind of, you know... Yeah, it's really weird. It's really inconsistent, and it almost, like you said, it seems like it would be easier to just go, yeah, we're not going to even acknowledge it.
Because it's distracting. I end up thinking about it in every episode.
And it timestamps the show, like in 10 years. Horribly dates it. Like, there's going to be a bunch
of... No one's going to want to watch season 6, just in general.
And I honestly don't know the right way to handle... addressing it or not. And I don't think there's a right or wrong way to do it. I just think that if you're going to do it, maybe lean in a little bit more.
Yeah, I think just commit to whatever you pick. But I don't envy anyone who has to make creative decisions in, especially during, like, there's restrictions, there's cutbacks.
Right.
There's a lot more factors at play.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting.
Yeah. What have you been... surfing through?
Not very much. Again, like a ton of YouTube videos. I just kind of have, like everybody who's following the continuity of the picture show knows there was no episode last week, so it was a art catch-up week. I was at the desk a lot and just played a lot of YouTube videos.
Well, there was an episode,
but
to
it was
tell
also
us that there was
not
no
an episode.
Episode.
Yeah. Check the archives for that if you're very confused right now.
I get sucked into, like, YouTube spirals like that.
Yeah, it's kind of cool to find some rabbit hole kind of video essays and things like that. I've watched a little bit of that Scientology show with Leah Remini on Netflix. I think it was an A&E.
I've seen parts of it.
Her sort of taking on Scientology. It's very interesting, but it also, like, mentally beats the tar out of me because it's kind of maddening at the same time.
Here are the worst parts of human
Yeah.
Nature.
It's like, here's a cult that's been accepted as a mainstream religion, and it's just sort of like, how are we all not seeing this? But
that's a bit of a downer.
A little bit. But I also recently watched an animated movie on, it was on HBO Max. It's called Batman Under the Red Hood. It's based on the comic series. I think Judd Winnick wrote the comic series. Mm-hmm. It's about the Red Hood, the introduction of the Red Hood into as a villain in
Jason Todd.
Jason Todd, right?
Okay.
And it's a really, I hadn't seen it in a few years, and a podcast that I'm going to talk about later did an episode. It's further back in their archives, but I listened to that episode about it, and it made me want to revisit the movie, so I did, and I'm really happy I did.
Is that one of those, like, late 90s, early 2000s Batman movies? Because they made so many of those.
No, it's an animated, I'd say 2010, 2012, somewhere around there.
Okay.
Animated feature, but, like, it's probably less than 90 minutes. It's a long cartoon, basically. It's really good. It's not, you know, a perfect movie by any stretch, but for an animated feature, DC really did some good stuff here and there.
DC does do good animated
work. Yeah, they really do. And that's one of the better Batman outings, I think.
Yeah, I can't remember what it is, but I remember from my childhood, like, there was a animated Batman movie. It had, like, what's the ice guy?
Mr. Freeze?
Yeah, Mr. Freeze. Yeah. He was in that. Just one of those weird nostalgia things.
Yeah. It was animated? Mm-hmm. It wasn't the Arnold Schwarzenegger Mr. Freeze, right?
It was not.
That's really worth your time, too.
It's not. Get to the chopper. I'm going to freeze it.
It's not even any one-liners that cool.
No, like, it wouldn't be.
It's terrible. But we didn't watch any of that stuff for this week. This week, we watched the 1988/2005 animated fantasy film My Neighbor Totoro. This movie is about two girls who move to the country to be close to their ailing mother and have adventures with the forest spirits who live nearby. We watched the 2005 English dub version. This was originally came out in 88. It was released originally in, I think, 1990 in the States. And then in 2005, Disney acquired the rights. It had some deal with Studio Ghibli to take them and do English voice cast dubs of them, and that's what we watched.
They did that with a few movies, didn't they?
I think most of the Studio Ghibli catalog is, or is it Ghibli? I'm not sure. They did like Ponyo.
I was gonna say I Howl's remember Moving that.
Castle yeah. that I've seen. I think they did it with the bulk of the catalog, and it's actually the dubs I've seen are really good.
I am generally against dubbing, but I think it works here.
I think it does work, and this cast is really interesting and really good. This has Dakota Fanning as Satsuki, Elle Fanning as Mei, Tim Daly as Professor Kusakabe, and Frank Welker as the voice of Totoro and Catbus. This movie was written and directed by animation legend Hayao Miyazaki, who also wrote the lyrics to the theme for Totoro.
The greatest song of all time.
If you have not seen this movie and you are curious what it is about, I'll even link a video to it in the show notes. Listen to the end credit song. The English translation is basically...
It spells it out for
you. It is exactly the movie, and it's great. I have been listening to the song most of the day.
And then this happened, and then that happened, and then that.
Living in the forest for such a long, long time. There you'll be with Totoro. Totoro. You only see him when you are very young. A magical adventure for you. It's magic for you. Every like, these scenes,
it's so literal,
are spelled out very literally. It's hilarious, but it's a super catchy song and super fun.
I like the beats.
This was my first viewing of this,
as was mine.
And to give you a preview into what I thought of this movie, this was also my second viewing of this. I watched this again today. I watched this movie twice in a 24-hour period.
Oh, wow.
I could not tell you the last movie I did that for.
I'm underprepared now.
I love this movie. I really did. This movie really wormed its way into my brain.
That's awesome. I could not watch it, like, back to back. This is a slow movie to do that for.
But it's
an enjoyable movie.
Is it a slow movie?
I think it is.
I think okay, let's start there. I think this movie shows very mundane things like waiting for a bus, but I'm never not interested while watching it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I'm always... There's something about the way this movie is laid out for you and the series of events that let you know when nothing's happening, something is about to happen. So you're just waiting for it. And so I'm never bored. I know something is always... If it's not happening right then, it's about to happen.
I didn't say this movie was boring.
No.
Slow.
I don't, but that's,
very different.
That's what I think of as. I think slow is. This is a semantic argument. I think slow is a almost negative sounding term. Where okay. I would just say more deliberately paced. It's not rushed. It takes its time.
It is deliberate. I think of it as slow because it kind of like, I think the goal of all of these scenes and how they do mundane things is to make it like tranquil.
Yes.
And so to do that, they have to put you in the moment. And to do that, it kind of milks the scene a little. Like they...
A little bit.
They take their time with each part of the movie, and that's not a bad thing.
No, I think that works.
It does have an effect.
I think it works in its favor. I don't think... I think it helps if this movie is only like an hour and a half. You know what I mean? If this was a two-hour movie doing this, I think it would kind of wear on you a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But the actual plot of the movie is very simple. It keeps moving the plot. Everything advances the plot. You know what I mean? Nothing is wasted. Everything that happens for a very specific reason.
That affects the things that happen after it.
Yeah. That either informs the character or kicks the can down the road to the next thing. So everything that is slow is, I think, in a way saying, pay attention to this. Pay attention to the goat trying to get the corn from May. And now you know how much May prioritizes that corn and what she believes that corn will do.
Right.
Like, all of these things are very, very specific and I think click in place to make this movie riveting is overdramatic, but I...
Engaging.
Yes, thank you. Engaging is the perfect word for it. I really locked in with this movie yesterday when I watched it. And today, I was supposed to be cutting the grass. And I said, you know what? I'm going to turn on Totoro and eat my breakfast and sit here. And I watched the whole thing again. And I just loved it. I love this movie.
That kind of points me towards what I wanted to talk about, which is that this feels like a specific brand of anime that's kind of like about the mundane.
Okay.
Like, so you actually said...
Well, you know anime far more than I do.
I am. I don't even think of myself as, like, a big anime fan.
But you can speak to, like, this brand of anime, so...
I went through a pretty hardcore phase of watching a bunch of different animes and stuff. And I've seen a lot of, like, dramas, whether it's movies or shows, but, like, there's sort of this focus in Western animation of animation is a tool, right? You see our cartoons are like Steven Universe and Infinity Train and Regular Show, all of these like elaborate
weird,
right? Like, it's more about the plot is weird, and then they show you very simple ways of acting out that plot because they like the animation is more of like a tool,
right?
And they still do beautiful things with it, but I feel like the focus is the opposite here, where they take something mundane, something everyone knows, and then they turn it into the most beautiful scene ever using art.
Sure.
And I think it's really cool.
This is a rule of thumb kind of thing that I have heard. It's not a hard and fast rule, but the idea that you only animate something that you can't do live action. Like, if you can, like, something like King of the Hill has no real reason to be an animated show. King of the Hill could be a live action show. There's no fantasy elements in King of the Hill. There's no big action scenes. There's nothing that can't be done in regular sitcom format.
Bob's Burgers is the same
thing. Bob's Burgers is very similar, yes. But I, you know, that's not a strike against these things for that, because, like, I still love King of the Hill. Bob's Burgers is great. It's very funny. But it's just a general rule. What I think a movie like this does, and I think this is sort of a Miyazaki thing in general, from what I've seen, is taking very mundane, very sort of everyday stuff that really doesn't need to be animated. But then you layer in like some fantasy element to it. And then it's like, oh, that's why this is animated.
Right.
But also, like, even if Totoro and Cat Bus and all these fantasy elements weren't in this, I would have a hard time denying that this should be an animated movie because the art is freaking beautiful.
It's so good.
It's unbelievable how great the backgrounds look on this. The action, just that rickety, like, moving truck, that three-wheeled truck thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, when it goes around a corner, you can see the weight of it moving around. It's just so beautifully animated and drawn. I love it. I could not love this animation more.
There's a lot of, like, lighting stuff, too. Like, when they're outside and you see the shadows and you can see, what's it called? Golden Hour?
Yeah.
But, like, it's in direct lines where it's like, oh, there's a building in this way. So, they just play with it, and it's beautiful.
It's great. It's fantastic. This is, like, in watching this, and my other point of reference that I remember, I don't remember Ponyo very much, but Howl's Moving Castle, these are my only Miyazaki references. But, like, it is easy to see just from these couple examples that I've seen why Miyazaki is so put on a pedestal. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like this legendary Japanese animation director. And this is just based on the art. The art is just, it's next level stuff. It's in the same way that we talked about this last season of Korra, and we talked about Avatar being this level up for TV animation. I think consider this movie is over 30 years old.
That's insane.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
No, it was hard to find anyone but Disney and maybe like Don Bluth doing this level of feature film animation. But this looks totally different from that. This looks like painted. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's a totally different style than anyone was doing in a mainstream way in 1988.
It's this... And anime lends itself to that because that's kind of... anime is, of course, a continuation sort of like manga,
right.
Which is the comic version. And that's meant to be like mass produced. So the style is designed to be quick and efficient. While also showing the right amount of detail. So, like,
right.
Anime is very, like, particular in that way of they're going to try to get the most bang out of their buck by making the style, like, quick to do so that they can do more beautiful stuff with it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's an economy of line. There's a lot of androgynous faces in anime. You know what I mean? Like, it's a lot of very middle-of-the-road character that you can... Here's an androgynous sort of base-level character. Anyone in the world can map themselves onto this character, you know?
Yeah.
This character is not Asian, it's not American, it's not black, white, it's barely male or female sometimes. And I'm not talking about the anime that has... giant boobs and crazy schoolgirl sexual innuendo. Like, I'm talking about just like baseline anime.
Yeah.
But this is like a level up from that. This is like, these are very distinct looking characters, I think, who have personality on their faces. They have the exaggerated expression, like when Mei starts crying and her mouth opens up real wide and you can, but it's still like, as ridiculous as that should look, I feel so bad for that little girl who just right. wants her mom. And you see this...
And the boy who's awkward about it.
Yes.
He's funny.
He's hilarious. Because they... And that's the real life aspect. They capture this idea that little boys and little girls like to pretend that they don't like each other.
Yeah.
And what that, the tension and sort of almost enemies that creates. I think it's beautiful. I think it's brilliant. And
it's wordless and it's
yes.
quick and it's just a background thing.
And yeah, exactly. It's a character trait and they never blatantly say it. They trust the audience to understand it and pick it up and appreciate that about these young characters.
Mm-hmm.
The other big emotional beat, I think, is when, Dakota Fanning's character, I'm sorry, Satsuki,
yeah.
When she is on the phone with her dad after they get the telegram and she's asking about her mom and she says, just wait by the phone. And you just sort of like see it in her physicality. You see it on her face. You see that she's terrified. And trying to hold it together. And that lasts all the way until she finally does break down crying in front of Granny. And that is like super emotional. And to be able to convey that with a character that has stripped down facial features, I think is just brilliant animation work.
It is. Yeah.
And great character work.
Like she even looks tense when they're walking.
Yeah.
Like the shoulders are up high.
Right. And she snaps at her sister. And I think that's props also to Dakota Fanning, who did, I think, some great voice work in this.
Mm-hmm.
And she's very young.
Yeah, they do a lot of the, like, the giggling and stuff. All those, like, sounds that aren't words. That was, like, surprisingly good.
Cause yeah.
I don't know. It's hard to mimic, like, anime has a certain, like, exaggerated style.
There's a weird
of
cadence
voice acting.
To it, yeah.
Right. And they kind of mimic that in a, I think, correct way. I think they get the emotion while kind of making it American, so, like, Americans can still relate.
Yeah, they get the gist of it without, without mocking what is, like, culturally... Asian about, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
without taking the original and sort of making fun of that. There's a, have you seen that show, the Toys That Made Us on Netflix?
No, but I've heard of it.
There's this really great episode about Transformers and how, and I say it's a great episode because it's talking about like the Japanese toy market. It's super interesting. And they're, you know, they're talking about designing these crazy toys that transform into things. But they're interviewing like these Japanese toy executives who don't speak English. So they have a translator. And I don't think it was intentional, but the way, there's something about the tone and the voice of the translator that's dubbing over this guy talking that almost seems like it's making fun of Japanese dubs of old, you know what I mean? Like there's it sounds stereotypical. I don't think it's blatantly racist, but it just is uncomfortable to watch. You know what I mean? And I think it's so easy to slip into that territory for American producers when they're dubbing over something from Asia to go into the stereotypical old Godzilla territory that almost like beats down the Asian culture part of it.
Right.
But I think this steps around that a lot. There's the thing I thought of when you brought it up is when Granny is like praying with the shoe by the pond. And it's just like this weird kind of murmuring where she's sort of whispering a prayer.
Yeah, but it's not very like,
it's kind of gibberish.
It's nonsense.
Right. But it's also not like an American making fun of like an Asian, you know what I mean? You ever see like a bad comedian who like makes fun of like
right, cause, Asian people? Right, because I'm pretty like, sure in the original scene, she was probably, it was probably like a Japanese prayer.
Right.
Like something that's cultural that cannot be replicated. That's the thing with taking something from another language and translating it, is you're losing something. And that's kind of why I like to use subtitles instead. Because like, it's still a translation, but they're able to be a little more literal with the translation of, this is the indication. You can play with the words a little more. Whereas with dubbing, you're also trying to fit the mouth movements right. and the timing and the emotion. So like, you can change the meaning of a lot just to keep the flow of a scene.
Right. If it takes 3 seconds to say something in Japanese, but 10 seconds to say it in English, you have to reword the English thing to make it fit
right.
the Japanese and then timing.
And then the English viewer hears that line and thinks the importance is about, like if they're talking about a bowl of ice cream, they're going to think, oh, 90% of that was talking about the ice cream.
Right.
You think that's important when the original language, they were talking about the bowl.
Well, we were laughing like, about the song. The song being a literal translation where it's like, right. I'm sure
there's nuances we're losing there.
I'm sure that it's more poetic in Japanese. But for us, it's sort of like on a, what's the one line? It's like so on the nose. It's like, on a moonlit night, he plays a magic flute in the sky. It's like, yes, literally, that is a shot in the movie.
That and is what he does.
It's so spot on that it's hilarious and also great at the same time. But
yeah, there's just a lot more challenges when you're trying to make something accessible.
For sure. But I think this movie handled those really well. I think this movie kept a lot of, like, this movie's not, like, inherently Japanese. They're not, like, pounding you over the head with like Japanese culture. It's just there, like the little temples in you know, on the roadside,
yeah,
and just the scenery, the house is inherently Japanese.
It almost feels like things were intentionally toned down to be more marketable to everyone else.
I don't think it was toned down. I think it was just sort of like, you know, in America they don't make movies that constantly tell people we're in America. This is a Japanese director setting a movie in Japan.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like, yes, this is how people live. There's a show I watch on YouTube called Welcome to the Basement, where they, it's a movie review show. And they brought up Soul, which we talked about at the beginning of the season.
It's a great movie.
It is a great movie. And the thing that Matt, one of the hosts, said is, I like this movie because it is about, it is racially diverse, but it's not about race. It's not about being black. It takes place in a black neighborhood around, centered around jazz, which is traditionally black culture music. But it's not about race in America. It's not a, it's not a mission. And I think this is the same way. This is a movie about a Japanese family that takes place in Japan, but it's not inherently about, it's such a more universal story than this. You know what I mean? With the exception of, you know, possible like allusions to forest gods and things like that, that may be more culturally significant.
Right. I think they in have Asia. I think they have like a offering thing for the spirits.
It's right? all over this movie.
Yeah.
Which is great. I love the weird spirituality of this movie. That
the winding up at the tree that was nowhere near their house.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And then you know, just the tree sort of finding you. You don't find it like.
Well, the yeah, there is the tree. I didn't think that tree followed. Are you talking about at the end when she runs to the tree?
No, I'm talking about in the beginning when she finds it. She's just in the bushes and she ends up in the tree.
No, that tree's like, there.
The path leads her to there, but she takes that path again. The tree's not there because the tree is there. Back where it was supposed to be.
The tree is there. The hole, like the dimension to
But Totoro. The bush never leads to the tree. The tree was, like, farther away. They had to walk to the tree.
I'm going to have to watch this movie again.
I watched it one time, and I know it better than you. Come on.
But the idea of being respectful to gods, leaving offerings for God, you know, like, these things that happen. Like, she gives the umbrella to Totoro.
Yeah.
You know? And then, you know, Totoro helps her out later on, you know, helps raise the tree up in the dream.
Right. That scene is so cool.
So good.
Like the fact that it's like pumping water, the motion that they're doing, dragging it up.
Oh, that's really good. I didn't even catch that part of it. Like, oh, that's why they kept showing the pump. That makes total sense now. Yeah. Good job, boss.
Thank you. But I also think there was another detail I lost. Moving on.
Okay. Well, there's there was the offering of the umbrella. They stop to get out of the rain and they step into like the, I think it's a Buddha temple. Mm-hmm. And she just sort of says, she's very, just like respectful to the statue. She goes, is it okay if we share your roof, sir? And then like, then.
She's asking for permission.
Right.
Like,
and then the boy stops and gives the umbrella to them. And then, you know, so it's sort of like, there is like a weird, they have this relationship is laid out with these gods. And I think it is like, is very like, living in harmony kind of message that is sort of resonating through
yeah, this. It's just like they're another part of their world.
Right.
I think another thing about like the spirituality here is the dad is kind of like, oh, well, you know, May got lucky. She saw the spirits. You might see the spirits one day, but also maybe you won't. And that's just how life is sometimes.
Yeah, the dad is actually a far more interesting character than I think he is on the surface.
He's definitely not there, but when he is there,
he's kind of, he's there, he loves his kids, he takes care of his kids, but he doesn't really know how to take care of it. Like, you can tell, like, he's more professional. Like, even his daughters get up and are making breakfast because he slept in too late.
Right.
You know, like...
I think the assumption is that the mom probably took care of them a lot more.
Probably was a little more attentive.
And but, that the oldest daughter kind of has to pick up some slack and stuff. Because she's shown, like, she's preparing, like, lunches and everything.
Oh, she's on it. Satsuki's on it, man.
Right. Which, those lunches, again, they look great.
Yeah, a little bento box full of sushi, yeah.
That's great. Anime loves, like, there's this weird food animation thing where I've seen a clip of, like, chopping vegetables, and it's, like, hyper-realistic and just, like, synced up beautifully. It's almost like ASMR. But
that's really wild.
It's cool.
But the other thing about the dad that I like in this is he's not one of those, like, 80s movie parents who are, like, mocking their kid for having seen something or being like, stop lying. Or, like, he believes maybe May's imagination ran away with her. And maybe he doesn't quite believe she really saw a forest spirit. But he's like, well, let's go check it out. Like, he's indulging her without being insulting to his children. And then, like...
He's kind of just, like, validating how they feel.
And he's also kind of saying, maybe you did. You know, maybe there is something here. And maybe it was in your mind and maybe it wasn't. But there is that sort of thing of, like... It's like the philosophical question is, like, is there a God? And it's, like, the answer of, like, does it matter? If you believe
the agnostic
there is
dad.
If you believe in it and it that helps you get through the day, then sure, go with it. You know, and I feel like the dad is like a good dad even if he can't get up and make breakfast. Like, he's so good to his daughters, and he just sort of rolls with what they tell him about Totoro, and I think that's cool.
Yeah, they kind of imply that they're, like, just playing along with the kids.
Yeah.
But then the neighbor, the grandma character, she says something like, oh, I saw the, what were the, like, darkness things?
The soot gremlins?
Soot
or
gremlins,
whatever.
Yeah. She said that she saw soot gremlins when she was a kid.
Yeah.
So this kind of implication that, like, they're playing along, but also, like, maybe kids are more in tune and they see, that's the thing a lot is that, like, kids are pure, so they can kind of see the things that we dismiss.
Oh, that is 100% correct, because in the song, the lyric says, you only see him when you're very young.
Well, that's
a magical adventure for you.
It's spelled out
for you.
Only if you're a kid. You
know, like, it is like that. And let's talk about influences on this movie. Because that leads me to something that kind of stuck out as obvious to me.
Okay.
Which is E.T. E.T. was out 6 years before this. And
82, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right around there. 81, 82. Somewhere, I'm pretty sure it was 82. And there is a line in E.T. where they're trying to convince little baby Drew Barrymore not to tell their mom. And Elliot says, grown-ups can't see him, only little kids. And she goes, give me a break. She doesn't believe it. Which is, we're totally lying. But in this movie, it is like... Oh, yeah, 100%. They even blatantly say it at the end, like, oh, no one else can see the cat bus.
You think Miyazaki saw E.T. and was like, oh, that's good.
I think there are elements from E.T. That found their way into this movie.
I think there's just general elements of the 80s. Like, the clothes, I think, is the main thing. Yeah. The outfits feel very 80s.
I thought the outfits
their
were pretty.
Their colors and...
Maybe color-wise, yeah.
I don't know, just what the father was wearing, and then Satsuki, she had, like, this orange outfit. I don't know.
Yeah, she had a yellow dress on. She had a bright yellow. I don't know, I thought everything was pretty ubiquitous from time period, across time periods, as far as that goes. But the other E.T. thing I thought of was when the tree grows and Totoro spins the top and they fly, you know, it's the flying scene from E.T.
Yeah.
I'm not sitting here saying Miyazaki stole from E.T. I think he took elements of E.T. and this core story about children who are missing a parent who find this sort of otherworldly creature mm-hmm. who helps them through it. I think that main theme, and I mean, honestly, I love E.T. E.T. was a huge part of my childhood, and I still, it's not just nostalgia talking, I still love that movie.
You are hearing it here first, folks. Don't even bother with this movie. Just go watch E.T. because it's the same movie.
I am going...
And it's better,
I'm going apparently. To go the other way on it and say, like, this is a better flying sequence than E.T. I think, a less stuck in the 80s version of E.T. I think this is a more timeless version of that story that I think a lot of people will look at E.T. and go, this is stupid. Look at BMX bikes and weird clothes. You know, that this is so old. You can't tell what time period this... no, I don't think
it's,
you can.
It's vaguely summer.
It's
like right. It could happen,
but even
any
like
summer.
Year-wise, yeah. You don't know what year this takes place or, you know, because not everybody has a phone, not everybody has a car and things like that, but... It's just sort of a more wide open and accessible story. And I think some of the sequences that it were influenced by something like E.T., I think Miyazaki improved on them. The flight sequence.
The missing kid, searching for the missing kid.
The missing
kid. Isn't
that
a thing in E.T.?
There is a point where Elliot is missing, yeah.
Okay.
But the discovery of Totoro, I think, is so much more charming. You know, when she sort of falls into the pit and he's just this big fat monster who's sleeping.
Yelling in each other's faces. It's cute.
And yeah, and then Satsuki, when she finds her way in there at the end and she lands on his chest and all you see is like those weird markings on the chest. You see her fall on this big mat and you know it's Totoro. She found him. It's just, it's great imagery. It's
like a callback.
It's yes. And it's presented really well. So I'm not trying to sit here and be like Miyazaki stole from, I think Miyazaki had a similar story that he told in his own unique way.
Right.
And I think it's great if these two like, you know, linked together in some way. These are two great movies that I think tell a really brilliant story in two very distinct, brilliant ways.
Yeah. I mean, I think Totoro is a better alien, but that's just my opinion.
Possibly agree. E.T. doesn't play a magic flute in the sky.
Right.
E.T. can't summon a cat bus. I mean, come on.
Totoro's not getting Satsuki drunk in the middle of science
class.
That's
true. That's very, very true. it's not a bad influence.
I like how casual the plot of this movie is. Like, I feel like...
I do too.
This movie could be on at any time and I could walk in and just sit down and...
There's no sections of this movie mm-hmm. that almost stand by themselves.
Right. And there's kind of no, like, there's no stress about what's going to happen or anything. You kind of just let the plot unfold.
That's the casual pace of this movie.
Right. And then I feel like maybe it's just me, but I saw, oh, mother's gonna die, like, the moment she's introduced. And then they didn't do it.
Right.
And that was, I think, better, because that would have really, that would have turned this into, like, Bridge of Terabithia, which is, you know, like, a movie only remembered because it was really sad at the end. Or, like, Marley or and me and
right.
All of those sad the death tragedy, at the end. Yeah. And that would have lessened the rest of the story.
And I think that's really interesting, because I thought it was going to take that turn as well when, like, the telegram came. And, you know, I'm like, oh, you know, this is the dark turn.
Right.
And really, the dark turn turned out to be May getting lost. You know what I mean? Like, that was the real... But it's couched in this idea of, like, the sick mom. And oh my God, this is the tragedy that's looming over the whole thing.
And it's funny, because that kind of puts us in the position the family is in, where there's this tension of, like, we're worried about the mom.
Sure.
Yeah. And then that feeds into it.
There's a really... But I think that is a great thing this movie does as well, is there is tension about the mom's health. But the family is not sitting there wallowing in it. The family is living their regular life.
They have a fun time at the hospital. They leave laughing on the bike.
They go to the hospital. They go to school. The dad goes to work. But when the telegram comes and everybody breaks a little bit, that's when you realize, like, yes, they're carrying on, but they haven't, like, forgotten how serious this thing is looming. Right. But this family is really just doing its best to carry on and hope for the best and hope that their mom comes home soon.
Yeah. They're acting like everything's okay, but, like, they're still a little worried all the time.
Right. And I don't think it's acting. I don't think it's, like, denial. I think they are living their lives, but no,
don't let it control.
There's an elephant in the room, yeah, for sure. And I think they don't make that elephant clear until the telegram comes and everybody is immediately on edge. And I think, I mean, this is a cartoon that puts this many layers into itself. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I can't get over how brilliant this movie is.
It's almost like philosophy. Like,
for sure.
This super casual display of life, and, like,
it's, we're, you know what I'm gonna say, it's a spiritual, it's a Zen movie.
Zen.
It's very, just come along with us, don't worry about, you know, right, we'll keep you in the moment here and meander through.
And I like the way that they teach lessons, whereas, like, Western stories, it's a lot of the story is gonna hinge on this, it's gonna be, like, a big theme, and it's kind of overt, whereas oftentimes in anime, they'll have, like, just an example. It'll be an overt example of something, but it'll just be minute, and they'll be like, hey, kid, don't do that. You should do this instead. Like,
okay.
I can't think of specifics, but there's a moment in this movie where, like, May is... she's being a little more disruptive than she should be, and her sister kind of scolds her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just this simple, like, life lesson that you learn in a scene rather than, like, the whole story.
And they're not telling the audience it's happening in a organic way in the story.
Yes.
It's not... I know what you mean. I feel like Western movies, not just animation, as a whole, Western movies trust their audience less. They
don't trust them at all.
They really want to make sure that, how do we make sure they know this is a strong female character? We'll put it in the marketing materials. We'll say it 6 times in the script. We'll do, you know.
We are so afraid of subtext.
We're so afraid that someone's not going to pick something up. And some criticisms that I hear of movies, I think sometimes they're right. There are people who don't pick up subtext.
Right, but that's okay.
That's on them. That's right. Not on the...
You're not making it for that person, then, if they're not picking up
exactly.
on...
Exactly. And I think these are kinds of movies, and you, like I said, you can speak to the anime as a whole much more than I can, but I think it's great that they leave this stuff up to you. They leave it to... They drop it, and you can pick it up and... Or you can leave it there and just enjoy the movie on a surface level.
Uh-huh. You said, like, I know about anime, but I think, like, the biggest...
Well, just more than I do.
I know, but I think, like, the biggest, outside of either of us, just look at Miyazaki's fan base.
Sure.
That's all the it's evidence huge. You yeah. need of, like, that... His style works, and he created nostalgia.
People love these movies, and I don't think it's because, nostalgia driven. I know people
No, because you live these movies, right. and because you become engaged with them, and it's just little slices of life with fantasy mixed in.
Right, but the fantasy serves the story of humanity. The story, the theme that he's trying to get to.
Mm-hmm. It draws out realism. It doesn't push it away.
Right.
This is not Alice in Wonderland.
No, it's not. But there are elements of Alice in Wonderland in this. With her chasing the small spirit down the rabbit
That's
hole.
True, yeah.
There is an influence there without... being like, mm-hmm. a remake or a reimagining of Alice in Wonderland.
It's like a reference. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's an illusion. But for sure, these movies have universal appeal because, like we said, these are Japanese movies, but they appeal to a wider audience than Japan because I think it's about people. It's not about race. It's not about culture. It's a broader theme than that.
Yeah.
That anyone can relate to. And I think that's as good as any movie can do in a time when we talk about representation and putting more and more people on screen because people are saying, I have to be able to see someone who looks like me on screen. And I do think that's a good thing. I think more importantly is you have to relate to the humanity of the character.
Right.
You know, we're putting these surface level things in a big conversation. These surface level things are being put ahead of actually telling a universally humanitarian story. And I think when you look at something like this that comes from another culture and locks in with as big of an American audience that it did, that is something bigger than, does someone look like me on here? Is this someone of my race? Or is this an experience that I can relate to? Because that's so much more powerful, I think.
I'm torn because I think both are important.
I think both are important. I don't want to come off as saying, and that's why we don't need...
No.
You know, like, but I think, yes, cast diversely, tell stories from different viewpoints, there's a lot of universality that has nothing to do with demographic.
Right. I think we need... I think your story should aim to be universal and understandable to all unless it's for a specific reason. Like, if you're making a movie that is about a culture or for a culture... Or to relate an experience that only a certain group of people have.
Right.
But like...
But you can still relate that to a wider audience. And if you do that well, you don't have to be from that culture to understand what they're saying about it. You know what I mean? Like, you can still communicate a struggle of something like Boys in the Hood that I saw being from a lily white farm town of 900 people, I understood what these black kids in South Central Los Angeles were going through at the time, because that movie does such a great job of conveying the terrible choices that some of these kids are faced with.
Right. It's a tool for, like, empathy and, like, understanding other people's situations.
Here's where I come from.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. And so, I don't know we're going with any of this, but...
I think my point there is that you should know what type of story you're trying to tell. So sure. If you, like, you don't have to aim to be universal, but you should know when you're aiming to be universal.
But there is a common thread that I think you can strike where, yes, you're telling a story of a certain culture. Can you communicate that to an audience not from that culture? And I think that's what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. Here's a story taking place in Japan that found universal appeal throughout the world. You know what I mean? Like, that's a huge feat. And that's a really cool thing to be able to do.
It is, yeah.
Do you have any other thoughts about this movie before we wrap up?
Dad, you know I have no thoughts.
Well, I took a shot. You know, yeah. I thought maybe you found a magic acorn that had sprouted a tree in your brain that would help you out.
I would love that, but no. I think every fantasy element of this movie looks in some way like a toy or a stuffed animal. They're very cutesy.
Yes, I agree.
Very fluffy, malleable, even the soot gremlins, they're kind of
They have like googly eyes on them and things like that.
They're like furry puffballs.
That's really interesting because the people are drawn, like I say, minimalistically, like you said, still with a lot of features to give them personality, but like also like human proportions. They're drawn fairly lifelike. And then when you put them next to this big, basic plush animal that has, they all have almost no bone structure to them. Mm-hmm. You know, like they're all curves. They don't have, you know, there's no elbows or anything. Their arms just kind of curve as big circles around.
Yeah, they should look unnatural, but they don't. Like,
it all works somehow.
Yeah, well, because it's again that relatability of, I think we were dying laughing at the part where Totoro, there's a drip off of his umbrella on his nose, and it's just that little nose twitch.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't look like he could exist in real life.
No, not at all.
But we all know a nose twitch. We accept it,
yes. Yeah. And he has all of the... Like, he walks up to her and just stands next to her. And he kind of starts scratching his ass. Like, like just sort of absentmindedly in a way like Homer Simpson would do. And it's just sort of like, oh, that's like this real characteristic of a real animal or person mapped on this absolutely absurd-looking ball of fluff who doesn't obey physics at all. You know, like, right. It's just this brilliant thing that when you put it next to something that looks real, shouldn't work at all, and somehow it does. I don't even know how they do it.
It's a way of, like, personifying something.
Absolutely.
It's taking on... being a person.
There's a weird thing where sometimes Totoro has no weight and he floats and flex, but then like when he wants to make all the rain fall out of the trees, he jumps and he has this real weight to him. So he's just an absolutely nonsensical physical thing that is believable at the same time. Yeah. It's so crazy. Yeah, when you really
think
about it.
He's as light as the wind, and he's also a gigantic
one. And he's also a giant monster. It's great. It's absolutely great. I could gush about this movie all day long. Are you going to watch more Miyazaki stuff?
I am, and I'm going to drift a little more towards his more wild stuff. I know, like Ponyo, I mean, it's another domestic life, fish out of water, kids literally. But there's one with like helicopters or like airplanes and a weird sky land.
I don't know. Castle in the sky and stuff like that.
I want the more out there stuff. I know one of his stories is about like a post-apocalyptic world, but it's not in like that drab.
Right.
It's a beautiful post-apocalyptic. So, as much as I enjoy like the simplicity that he goes for in his movies,
in this movie, in particular, yeah,
right. But I would like to see more of the outlandish that he can do.
Sure, yeah.
So I think that's my next aim with him.
Simplicity is a really good way to put this movie. And I think that that is a big part of the appeal for me. I've been intimidated by Miyazaki because he has such a huge body of work. And when you get to a point where it's like, I don't even know where to start.
Right. Because what if I pick the worst one?
Right. J.F. Dubow was talking about Clive Barker on Twitter today. And Clive Barker always seemed intimidating to me because he seemed like smarter horror. That when I was younger, I'm like, oh, this is for like hardcore horror people. And it's more like intellectual than like Stephen King. And that's a bar too high for me. And then by the time I was like, you know, I kind of maybe was able to get over, like, Clive Barker's collection, his collected works, it's so huge, I don't even know, like, what's the best thing to start with. Like,
right, you were too busy waiting.
And you get to a point with, when you look back on somebody's huge body of work, you don't know where to start. But I'm glad I didn't start here. I have seen Howl's Moving Castle. You want something weird that is batshit crazy in the best way.
It is interesting.
But this movie, I think I expected something more complicated. And I was pleasantly surprised. I'm like, this is a very simple story. And it's a very charming story. And I think that's why it got a hook in me so much. This is just a beautiful, simple story that I loved for that reason. But I'm with you. I'm going to check out more of his stuff. I think I'm just going to start checking it off, going to HBO Max and going, this one looks good, and watching that. But I am also looking forward to more weird stuff like Howl's Moving Castle, more real big fantasy swings.
Right. That's honestly what I expected more from this movie.
Exactly.
And instead I got a haunted house story.
You got pretty much. Yeah, Mr. Snuffleupagus.
Yeah.
But, that's right. I'm gonna check out a lot more Miyazaki stuff and mundane along these lines. I expect to enjoy that, and I expect to at least revel in the weirdness of the big bizarre stories that he tells as well.
Right.
So I'm glad we watched this. I'm glad we brought some Miyazaki on the show.
Some art about every day.
And checked out something new for both of us.
Yeah. So, it was fun.
It was fun.
That's my take.
Obviously. It was fun. I really enjoyed
it. We have a lot of fun on this show.
Yes, we are having a good time. But enough of that good time. Let's close this out. And
good time's over.
Good time's over. Moving on to shout outs.
Which are bad times.
good times for other people. We're spreading the love here. What do you got today, Oz?
That's right. I'm shouting out something no one's ever heard of. NASA. But more specifically, I did a report this week on the Ingenuity helicopter, which is one of the most recent Mars rovers. And yeah, there's a mars.nasa.gov page. It's a website that like just kind of lists all about it, and it has like progress reports, but it's like a huge deal. Like, right. we have a helicopter on Mars.
Yeah.
And I know it's like we have helicopters here all the time, but
we have atmosphere here too.
That's right. We have an atmosphere, we have a different gravity. So they had to completely reinvent everything. And there's been 4 test flights, and they've all gone incredibly well. And this is more of a prototype. But it implies so much, and this page kind of goes into that about how this unlocks like what'll be the future rovers, because like before we weren't even driving on Mars, and now we've perfected rovers so much that we're kind of outgrowing them, and drones are going to be the new way that we kind of reach the harder parts of Mars. And this is to get samples and survey geological activity and stuff. So it's pretty useful.
Cool. Yeah. Maybe we can grow some potatoes to feed some starving people here.
Hey, there you go.
Yeah, all right. Thanks, helicopter.
The Irish might have something about that.
The space Irish?
That's right.
I'm going to shout out a podcast that my friend Heather Welch introduced me to. It's called On the Subject. It is a movie podcast, just like us.
Hey.
These guys are great. They just really, they're great personalities. They you know, play games. They try to guess the box office at a time that a movie can't, you know, over the top 5. Fun. And man, these guys know like what year movies came out. I'm like, that is impressive. But they're just a really fun group of guys, and I wanted to shout them out because I think they have a really fun movie podcast. You know, there's a million movie podcasts, which means the ones you enjoy are basically the personalities you gel with. And
right, it's individual to you.
Yeah, and I think this is a great personality-driven show. Also, they've done some of the same movies that we've done, and it's interesting to listen to some of the things that they dug out of. Like, they have a Where the Wild Things Are episode, and it's like...
Well, that's cool to see, like... 2 very different conversations sparked by one movie.
It is. You can kind of see like a Venn diagram of like, oh, we both picked this up. That's almost like, it's like validating. Like, yes, somebody else got this too. And then like, they're also saying, oh yeah, and also this. And I go, oh, I didn't even pick up on that. That's great. So you get to see like other perspectives.
Right. I know it's hard to believe, but there are... very few things. There's a few things we miss in movies.
There's one or two, you know, like, so I like to, a lot of times I see them, but I like to leave them for the other podcasts to pick up.
Oh, that's nice.
You know, you got to spread the love a little.
We do charity work here.
On the Subject is great. They're part of the Geeks Rising Network, and I really recommend you check them out. If you like our show, I think you'll like their show. Just don't leave us for them.
Nice.
But
there's room for 2 of us.
Yeah, there is. There's room on your podcatcher. That's it for shout outs. And I want to take this opportunity to say thank you for listening to this episode of The Picture Show. If you enjoy our show, please leave a review on your podcatcher of choice. It helps our visibility and it helps us grow the show.
Do you know another way to help our visibility?
No, how?
To help us grow? It's by telling a friend. So, it might take you a while to find that friend, because they may have run off to go find their friend Totoro. That's true. They're very young and can see him, that is.
Tell your neighbor, Totoro
about us. That's right. unplanned, but perfectly in sync. Really? That was kind of cool.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah, tell people about us. That's the best way to help our podcast
grow. Word of mouth is huge, actually. It's part of the reason we recommend other podcasts and other shows. And I love to tell people about shows that I like. So I like to think that we're helping people out, and it would help us out a lot if you would tell a friend about us.
I mean, if you like something, why wouldn't you tell?
Why would you tell people about it? Austin, it is your pick next week. So what are we settling in with?
We are watching Cargo, a 2018 Netflix original movie.
Oh, no. Another Netflix
original. Don't you dare. Okay. This is a good one, I promise. It's got Martin Freeman, and it's the zombie apocalypse, and there's a baby.
I hope this is like The British Office, but it's post-apocalyptic instead.
That's exactly what it is. It's legitimately good, which is rare for a Netflix movie. And yeah, I think it does some original stuff with zombie material, which in 2018 is kind of hard to see. It's also very cliche with the zombie stuff at some parts, but I think, I picked it because I'm interested to hear what you think about it.
I'm willing to accept tropes if they are done in an interesting way that holds my attention. I'm not anti-trope,
All right.
You know, you got to carve me out a good story there, too. So, something like, probably around this time is when I watched a Korean horror movie called Train to Busan.
Have you seen it? I have not, I need to.
Oh, we'll bring it on here at some point.
It left Netflix before I could, and then
We'll figure it out. Because that is also, I was like, more zombies. You know, like, this time The Walking Dead was already tired. So,
But they're Asian zombies. But it's totally different.
It does make me believe that you can still tell a compelling story with something tired like zombies. Or 10 years before that, vampires. Like, something can breathe new life into this. So despite the fact that this has the Netflix label on it, I am going to go in hopeful. And hope that, I think Cargo might actually be on my list, but I've never seen it. It was one of those things that came out that I bookmarked and never got to. So,
yeah.
This will make me watch it.
I think it got general thumbs up from people.
Okay.
Critics and stuff.
All right. We'll check it out then.
That'll be next week.
All right. Austin, what's your social media handles?
I am not sure. That is...
Old Horview on Twitter.
That's one of them. It's where I review whores. where I view whores. But then I am also Austin N. Rude on Twitter and Austin.N.Rude on TikTok.
All right.
That is me. What are you?
I'm at Phil Rude on Twitter, at PhilRude75, and you can get all of our episodes at PhilRude.com. Also there, if you click the tab for original art, you can buy the artwork that I do for this show. I've got a bunch of it listed. This week, hopefully by the time this episode posts, I will be caught up and have our newest stuff up there. All the season one artwork that's available is there. And probably about half of season two so far. So if you want to buy the artwork that I do for the YouTube videos, it is available on my website. That's philrude.com under the original art page.
You know, an elaborate way of getting you to do a commission would be to convince one of us to watch a movie and then buy the artwork afterwards.
Yeah, you should do a Star Wars movie.
Oh, boy. So that's where you can find us and some incredible art.
Yeah, that's it. That's it for this week. Austin, do you want to read the credits?
Yep, we did everything ourselves.
Well, there you have it. We'll see you next time on The Picture Show.
See ya.
Hey, this is Kate. I'm a forensic psychologist and crisis clinician, and I collect stories. Everything from true crime to trauma to parenthood. There's a lot more in common between depression and sociopathy, or between serial killers and podcasters, than you might think. Are you sure you really want to know? This is Ignorance Was Bliss at iwbpodcast.com and iwbpodcast on social media.
Hi, this is Mouse.
I'm Weens.
We have the Mouse and Weens podcast.
Mouse and Weens.
I'm a big sister in San Diego with kids, and I'm married.
And I have no friends. No, I'm just kidding. No, I do. I have friends. I just don't have any boyfriends or love. Anyway, Mouse and Weens podcast. You should listen to it.
Yeah,
it's not really depressing.
Fun. We talk about family stories, life and love, and kids, and all the things you're interested in. We promise.
Yay!
Celebrities in Hollywood, too.
Poke your little turtle head out and come listen to us.
Mouse and Weens. Bye.